Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I am Lisa Bobs.
I am John Steinberger.
Glad to have you back with us after a couple of weeks. Lots of things to talk about coming up in just a bit. We'll talk one of the best baseball rivalries around, Cubs-Cardinals, with huge Cardinals fan Will Leach. That'll be a fun conversation coming up in just a bit. Let's start things off here today talking about social media and some things that that have caught our eye. One thing a piece, I think, is what we'll go with here on that. John, let's start with you. Social media.
One thing.
Okay, well, one thing. So I think just this morning I saw an interesting thing on social media on Twitter somewhere. I don't exactly remember where I saw it, but then Deadspin picked it up, which Will Leach originally founded.
Yeah.
But the thing I noticed is Bartolo Colon.
Yes.
This is just a coincidence, but today is his birthday.
43?
43 years old. Very, very interesting guy. Pitched a game last night. He's a professional baseball player, pitches for the Mets, who have like a bunch of young fireballers, and 43-year-old Bartolo Colon. If you don't know what Bartolo Colon looks like, look him up. He's definitely an interesting looking.
I'm Googling right now.
He's definitely an interesting looking guy.
Is his nickname Big Sexy these days?
Yeah.
Big
let's
sexy.
Just say he.
Ooh, I'm not Googling
he's
that.
Your he's your classic, does not look anything like an athlete baseball player.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
I've seen him before. Like, in, yeah, okay.
So a couple weeks ago, he's 43 years old. I think he's been in the league for 16 or 17 seasons now, a lot. Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw he's the last remaining Major League Baseball player to actually have played for the Expos.
Yes.
So this is a long way of going around. He's been in the league a long time. He's pitching for the Mets for a couple of years. He's kind of becoming a folk hero just because watching him do things that aren't just pitching are fun. Like, he'll make fun plays in the field. But a couple weeks ago, 18 years into his Major League career, he hit his first home run, which was amazing.
He creamed it.
Yeah, and we should put up, there's a video of someone intercut his home run to the natural.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Yes, I will find that.
But anyway, this morning I saw on Twitter that he, in last night's game, he basically went up and during the first pitch he told the catcher, "I'm not going to swing. My back hurts too much. Just throw it right down the middle. I'm not going to swing." And I think maybe they didn't believe him the first time, but then they just kept throwing it. Which I just think is great. He also, the reason his back hurts is because he hit the home run. That's
he swung too hard.
Yeah,
oh, no.
He swung too hard. He said, I hit a home run a couple weeks ago. My back hurts. I'm not going to swing anymore. So that's amazing. I don't know. Anytime I can talk about Bartolo Colon is a win in my book. So if you're not familiar with Bartolo Colon, look him up. He's 43 years old. He's probably the oldest player in Major League Baseball, right?
If not the oldest, very close to it. And the other thing about Bartolo that's just awesome is these days he basically gets hitters out by throwing slow fastballs,
right.
Throwing nothing but slow fastballs. But he spots his pitches where he wants them. And
well, and I mean it's great to think about the Mets pitching staff because you have a bunch of people who throw the ball really hard.
Upper
and
90s,
and that's what you're 100. Going after for 3 days, and then in comes Bartolo. It's just amazing. But anyway.
Yeah, I Google searched him, not under Big Sexy, not going to Google that, but I Googled Bartolo Colon, and just the images alone are fantastic. Yeah. He's great. That's good. I like it. Is it my turn?
It is.
So you guys talked for a really long time, so I have two, and
okay.
I'll be really short.
Right.
So the first one that I noticed, I think it was a game that happened last week. For the very first time, a team was fined, not an owner, but the team itself was fined for a press release criticizing referees.
Mm.
That team was the Seattle Reign, a women's professional soccer team here in the United States. And this is what the release said.
Okay.
And this is why I'm reading this. This is why I chose this. Quote, "The referee apparently suffered from a strange form of paralysis that prevented him from pulling a yellow card from his pocket until late in the game, despite a plethora of bodies in blue that littered the field." So people were asking around, like, has a team, because Mark Cuban has been fined many times for making, you know, so, but like the team itself got fined. This was kind of a first. And the money is going to go to some charity, so it's all good. But still, I thought it was really funny that because, you know, teams after games each issue a media release about we won, we lost, here's what happened. Mm-hmm. And the Rain chose, had somebody write, and it made it through whatever censor or editor that they have. And I just thought that was really good. So the second thing is just a video that, Brian, I will send you the link to so you can pop it up on the web. Mm-hmm. It's called Your Mic Is On. I spend some time a couple times a week in the sports subreddit, which is huge. It's got like 6 million people following that subreddit. If you go to reddit.com/r/sports, you can go there. And they talk about all kinds of sports. And this is a bunch of armchair quarterbacks, just people mm-hmm. talking about sports, but somebody posted a link to a video called Your Mic Is On, and it's a bunch of officials and players who forget or don't care that they are mic'd during a game, and it's 2.5 minutes, and it's pretty funny, and I bet there are a lot of videos like that out in the world, but my favorite one is a football linesman saying to another, "Damn it, Donald," really loud. It's pretty great. So we'll post a link to that. And also the rugby referee is actually very funny too. And he totally gets in a good dig at soccer in there as well. So that's my social media finds.
All right. Your mic is on.
We have to remind ourselves of that in here, I think.
Yes.
Sometimes too.
Yes, we do. Mine just is a little more kind of your typical sports talk topic. It just caught my eye today. Apparently Magic Johnson made a recent appearance on Jimmy Kimmel's late night show. With my current schedule, as you might guess, I don't watch much late night TV, so I did not see this when it happened. But Magic Johnson made an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel's show and was talking about Kobe Bryant, who just retired after 20 years, I think, in the NBA. And Magic Johnson made the comment on Jimmy Kimmel's show that Kobe was the greatest player. His quote was, "greatest player ever to wear the purple and gold," basically meaning greatest Lakers player ever. That got me to thinking, you know, who is the greatest Lakers player ever? They're my team. I've rooted for them since I was about 6 years old. And Mike DeCourcy for the Sporting News wrote a column kind of in response to what Magic said and said, "Magic, no, Kobe's not the greatest Laker ever. You are." So I kind of looked around a little bit online and looked at a few stats, looked at some different things. And basically, the greatest Laker of all time basically comes down to one of two players, either Magic, who really kind of changed the game in a lot of ways, being a point guard who's 6'8", 6'9", could play almost any position on the floor, ran the fast break for the Lakers in the 80s to perfection. Or,
please say Kurt Rambis.
Yeah, well, he made Kurt Rambis look good, for crying out loud. So the other choice is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who, you know, won several titles with the Lakers, won some MVP awards with the Lakers. Probably about the only thing you could ding Kareem for was he spent his first 5 or 6 years playing in Milwaukee, you know, some of his best years as a player. But I think it really probably comes down to one of those two guys you can make the case for best Lakers player ever. But anyway, I thought it was just fun. Magic kind of being self, deprecating.
He probably knew what he was doing.
Yeah, perhaps maybe Magic just wanted to get people to talk about him again and say, "No, Magic, no, you
no,
are the best
awesome.
Player."
No, you're awesome.
So anyway, those are a few things that stood out to us on social media this week. We'll put some links up in our web post about that.
And we always want to hear from you guys what you're seeing on social media too, and we'll talk about our Twitter account later, but yeah, we want to hear. We can't see it all.
We try.
We try, but we can't see it all.
Speaking of sports going on right now, things kind of wrapping up. Spring sports are wrapping up on the University of Illinois campus. It was kind of a big couple of weeks for Illinois baseball and softball. They were softball made the postseason. They made the NCAA regionals for the first time since 2010. A very good first season for their head coach Tyra Perry. It was not quite as successful for Illinois baseball, John.
No, after last year's huge season in which a lot of people thought they were going to make the actual College World Series and kind of got a bad draw with Vanderbilt, they didn't even make the Big Ten tournament this year. But as far as I, and I'm not huge into college baseball, but as far as I can tell, I think they still have a lot of good young players and should be a bright future for both teams. Is that correct?
I think that's accurate. Yeah, the baseball team this year, you know, finished 28-23. It was their final record,
right.
So it by no means was a bad season. And they kind of had a bad luck draw in their Big Ten schedule. They didn't play any of the bottom feeders in the conference this year. The three worst teams,
right.
They didn't play any of them. So they kind of got the bad draw there in terms of their Big Ten schedule. But yeah, I think the future is bright for that program. One team still going, the Illinois men's golf team. They are playing in the NCAA championships starting on Friday, I believe it is.
That is a team that is due to win a championship based on how they've played over the last 5 or 6 years. They're always in it, and probably not controversial to say the best program on on the campus right now, probably.
Yeah, I think you can very easily make that case, no question. So we'll follow Mike Small's Illinois men's golf team. Lisa, we're getting into Grand Slam tennis season, the French Open.
It's the most wonderful time of the year where you have like a tennis major every other month that goes on for weeks on end. Yes. Unfortunately, we had a graduation in the family over the weekend, so I was not able to watch any of the early round matches, but I was following along online, a little bit of Twitter. And so far, there haven't been any huge surprises. You know, a seeded player always gets dropped in the first round. What did surprise me a little bit was some of the trouble that some of the players on the men's side have had early on. Andy Murray, his match had to be suspended halfway through because of darkness, but he was behind after two sets. He actually ended up winning today. I think he played that. And I thought he would. I mean, the guy he was playing was 37 years old, considerably older than he. And Andy Murray has been around the block enough to know how to – if he's got fresh legs the next day, he's gonna beat that person. I mean, he just is. So he won. Stan Wawrinka, who is the defending champion, had to go five sets. And, you know, and he also, you know, had the mental fortitude to be able to rally and come back. But if you're him, you do not want to go five sets in the first round of the French Open, because it's just going to get tougher from there. You know, typically you're going to win in three sets if you're a guy, two sets if you're a woman in the top five. That's pretty much expected. So to be taken to five sets, or, you know, Andy Murray was down two sets and had to come back, I mean, that's kind of huge. But he won. Rafael Nadal won. He's in fine form, and there's a lot of discussion that he may actually be able to pull it off again. This is kind of his tournament, so that's pretty exciting. On the women's side, I haven't followed as much. There's a player from Spain named Gabriel Muguruza who is sort of a dark horse favorite to win. She's the fourth seed. She barely won in her first match, so everybody's like, oh, my God, now what? You know, and I don't think Sharapova's playing. I don't think she can.
Yeah, I think she's suspended or...
Right,
yeah.
And Serena is probably going to, you know, kick everybody's butt. But I like Sloane Stephens. She's an American player who has been trying to rise for the last few years. She's a very powerful player, but mentally kind of inconsistent, so it'll be interesting to see how she is doing. I think right now, though, the thing that is making me slightly grumpy is the women's draw is also the big topic today is Eugenie Bouchard. She's a Canadian player. Mm-hmm. All anybody wants to talk about is her eating disorder, and she's talking about it too. And talking about body image and weight loss. And so they're focused on the press is focused on the weight loss, and they keep asking her about it. And she was really – so I don't have all the details, but you never hear. I mean, no guy is ever going to be asked about is he okay if he's like thinner or has dropped a bunch of, you know what I'm saying? So that's kind of annoying. She's really young. I think she's in her very early 20s. Is a really good player. Has been under a lot of pressure. I don't know what else was going on, but I'm a little bit annoyed that that's a big part of this conversation on the women's side of the draw, because there's no conversation like that on the men's side of the draw. So. French Open just started, though, over the weekend, so we've got two more weeks of tennis. ESPN is not carrying the game, so I'm trying to figure out what alternate means to watch the games. And not to say that I would actually watch the games while at work, but the time difference is such that a lot of the matches are being played during the day. So I'm going to try and figure something out so I can, you know, keep up, see what's going on. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting on the men's side. Wawrinka, just to go back to him for a second, is notoriously mercurial, I think, and can get out of the game mentally pretty fast, tends to beat himself up, smashes rackets, beats himself on the head with the racket and stuff. So he seems to have mellowed out in the last couple of years, and he's very much like the tortoise in The Tortoise and the Hare, where he's had this slow incremental rise. He's a little older than a lot of the players. He's just sort of worked his way up from being top 20 to top 10 to now top 5, and he's won, you know, a major or two, like a Grand Slam or two. So it'll be interesting to see how he, you know, the expectations are pretty high that he's going to repeat as a champion. But you've got Nadal, who's pretty awesome, and Djokovic, who's always, he's kind of like Serena Williams. Everybody's sort of like, you know, he's amazing. So so we'll see what happens.
time for our rivalry segment. Took a break from that last time, but with the Cubs and Cardinals playing this week in a series, we thought it was a great time to talk about that that great baseball rivalry. John and I are big Cubs fans. Lisa, I'd call you maybe a Cubs sympathizer. Would that be fair?
Definitely a Cubs sympathizer. I'm a Twins fan, so
okay.
Being from Minnesota. But yeah, I'm a Cubs sympathizer.
Okay. Well, we had to bring in the Cardinals perspective, and who better to do that than Will Leach, big Cardinals fan, Mattu native, U of I grad, writes for many, many publications. And Will, thanks for joining us, first of all. Appreciate you taking the time.
Of course. It's nice to talk to two Cubs fans and a Neville Chamberlain standing idly by.
Yeah. that's a first.
To history. The rest of us are screaming of the terrors that are coming, and you, unfortunately, have chosen the wrong side. Thanks for having me. If you get an idea of where I'm going to be coming from in this conversation.
And I just wanted to get kind of your general thoughts on this rivalry, Will. You wrote a book a few years back called Are We Winning, which was the setting of the book was you and your dad going to a Cubs-Cardinals game at Wrigley. It happened to be the game where the Cubs clinched the division in 2008, if I might point that out. But and just your general thoughts on this rivalry, it's a great one, but it's kind of an interesting one in the fact that it seems like over the years the two teams have been rarely good at the same time.
Yeah, it's almost as if they'd been purposely trying to avoid each other. There have only been 4 years. 4 or 5 years over the last 20 that the Cardinals haven't made the playoffs. 4 of those years, the Cubs went to the playoffs. Like, it is as if they were trading spots. Of course, that ended in 2015, much to my chagrin as a Cardinals fan. But yeah, you know, this is what we've kind of always wanted. You know, I said growing up in Mattoon, you know, it's a little bit more Cardinals an hour south of Champaign, and you're probably 65, I'd say 75, 25. And I think as you go up, that number starts to increase on the Cubs sides. And as you go down, it starts to increase on the Cardinals side. So, but, you know, certainly, you know, one of the things I've always kind of found amusing is, you know, I'm a big Illini fan, but I'm also during baseball season, I find myself getting at loggerheads with a lot of Cubs fans. I think speaks well to the rivalry is that, like, this is all sort of tied together. The idea that this is not people from Boston screaming at people from New York or people from San Francisco screaming at people in Los Angeles. This is, you know, these are generally kind of ideologically and geographically aligned fan bases. You know, one of the reasons the Cardinals Cubs rivalry is so good is because Cardinal fans and Cubs fans are both among the biggest, most loyal fan bases in baseball. They're both jewel franchises for Major League Baseball. So it doesn't mean as much. Like, the Cardinals and Royals theoretically would have a rivalry, but the Royals, until very recently, have just not really been able to hold up their end of the bargain, not just in competitive aspect, but really in a fan base aspect. Even when the Cubs were struggling, you knew that they were kind of this looming giant. They had this great fan base and a lot of money and a motivated ownership. You knew they were coming. And so therefore, they've always kind of been this lingering thing. So yeah, but they've never actually been together at the same time. In a lot of ways, I feel like one of the reasons for the Cubs' resurgence, such as it is that the Cardinals have been so good for so long that they've been a target. Certainly the Cardinals have been consistently good for basically 2 decades now, and they've given someone for not just the Cubs but also the Pirates, and I think eventually the Brewers and Reds to shoot at. You know, I think that the Cubs recognized that they couldn't just do it half-cocked in a lot of ways. They really needed to kind of fundamentally change the organization, or otherwise they weren't going to be able to compete with what the Cardinals are doing. And clearly they've done that, succeeded, and I think for a lot of people have even surpassed the Cardinals.
So one thing, Will, you know, like, okay, so I'm a Cubs sympathizer, more of an observer of the culture here, and I was just having lunch, and I think when the Cardinals and the Cubs play each other, at least here in this part of Illinois, it seems like it's just one constant bragging rights game. Yeah. Like, I see Cardinals jerseys and I see Cubs jerseys and I see the Cubs flags and I see the, you know. And so, but I also think it's interesting to be a Cubs fan here, because when the Cubs aren't doing well and the Cards are doing well, it's different than being in Chicago and living on the North Side, which I did for 5 years, and everybody's just sort of commiserating together. And here, if you're a Cubs fan, they're losing. Like, you get a lot of crap from people, I think, from the Cards fans. Like, they are merciless. And so there's this sort of bubble of protection in Chicago that I don't think you have here in Central Illinois.
I think that's true, and I think the flip side of that is, you know, with all as much grief as the Cardinals took after the Cubs beat them in the NLDS last year. And to be clear, they didn't just beat the Cardinals. This was not a, oh, the Cardinals just were so close and the Cubs snuck away with it. They bombarded the Cardinals in that series. That was my, that was actually my 40th birthday weekend that all that happened. So I felt like it was a reckoning for 40 years of a wretched life, that this was what I had to pay. But Cardinal fans are getting it back in a lot of ways. And, you know, as much as I love the Cardinals and want the Cubs to lose, it's hard to argue the Cardinals don't have it coming. But again, that is one of the nice things about the rivalry, is that, you know, certainly the Cardinals have had a lot of success for a long time, and have had more success than the Cubs for 100 years or so. Who's counting? But certainly, I think that it's not like Illinois mocking Northwestern is probably the best way to put it. Like, even though the Cubs have generally not been as good as the Cardinals, the Cubs are formidable. They are a formidable opponent. They're a formidable fan base, and they are loyal. And you knew once the Cubs got good, and they were eventually going to get good, that wave of people were going to come, and there was going to be a reckoning for Cardinal fans. And I think you've seen it. But, you know, I also think that one thing I've definitely noticed among Cubs fans, which I understand, you know, you talked about Brian, you talked about my book, Are We Winning? It was my father and I going to a game at Wrigley Field, but it was also one of my best friends from the University of Illinois, who I worked with at the Daily Illini, who's been a die. He loves the Cubs the way that I love the Cardinals. And he is, you know, down, always been downtrodden, like a lot of Cubs fans have been for a long time. But if you talk to him about this season, he's like, oh, well, we're winning the World Series this year. Like, it is the most matter-of-fact thing in the world, which I have to say, as a Cardinal fan, is a delightful thing to hear. Because if it doesn't work out, we will enjoy pointing that, just how confident. Like, that's the thing with the Cubs this year. That is very fun. They're undeniably a very likable team. But the thing about all of that is, it's all built up for them this year, and all that stuff with the mimes and the cubby bears and all that stuff. That's really cute as long as you win the World Series. But if you don't, that becomes, next year the pressure gets a little tighter, and everyone's like, wait, we're the Cubs, are we going to do this? Right now, this is the really fun year, but if they don't win the World Series this year, I feel like that turns quite a bit.
Well, I think that's a good point, but I also, I don't know, as a long-suffering Cubs fan, I hear all the accolades and expect the others should drop. In fact, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. You know, we were looking undefeatable, going to win 130 games, and now we've lost 8 of 12. And if you look at Cubs Twitter now, I don't think people are feeling quite as confident. We need a new starting pitcher right now, and all that stuff. So I don't know how your friend is so optimistic, because my feeling is that it's the great setups. It's the worst setup since 2003.
It's like Charlie Brown. Yeah. It's like Charlie Brown with a football.
It's also worth noting that, like, any time we attach the word Twitter to any sort of fan base, it's worth remembering we're getting the in-the-moment panic moment. Like, by all means, Cardinals Twitter is just as bad. Like, when everything is something, Cardinals Twitter during the NLDS last year was an unhappy place to be. It was a very dark place. But that's what happens. You know, that's the baseball in so many ways is just not fit for Twitter in a lot, because every game your emotions get so high. I'm on Twitter as well. But one of the things I started doing was I would start just tweeting at Cardinals. Anytime I had something to say about the Cardinals, because I would get so emotional that I would, like, irritate everyone that was following me that wasn't a Cardinals fan with these the next morning you wake up, you're like, okay, that was, like, it's like a bender, you know? You just wake up like, wow, I really lost my mind over that game I'm going to forget in 3 days. And I think that's one of the nice things about a baseball season. It really is a long thing, and the Cubs get off to this incredible start. And again, to be clear, you know, even though they have come back down to earth a little bit, I think they're still the best team in the division. But that is the fun. You know, I think everyone is kind of learning. Everyone's adjusting to this new reality all of a sudden, that the Cubs are this terrific team. And so if they have a moment where they lose three in a row, like every great baseball team has done throughout baseball history, everybody kind of freaks out a little bit. But I suspect in a week you may forget those three losses real quick.
So, well, what do you think we talk a lot about social media on this podcast. What kind of effect do you think social media, particularly Twitter, but I think any social media, has had on not just this rivalry, but on rivalries in general?
I think they've weaponized them in a way that to be honest, sometimes I'm very uncomfortable with. You know, Twitter in particular, but I think all social media as well, it doesn't do nuance well. And, you know, the idea that I am a Cardinals fan and an open, cheerful, love my Cardinals, hope the Cubs lose Cardinals fan does not mean that I hate I have no, I don't like people who are Cubs fans, or I think everyone on the Cubs is a terrible person, or that I want, or I think Wrigley Field is a horrible place, or any of that. And I think because, you know, what I think what it does, I don't think it makes the rivalries any different. It's the thing I always try to remind people is, yeah, listen, I, you know, with Deadspin, I've been online. I've been in the middle of this scrum for 12 years, this kind of online scrum for so long. I know it feels like Twitter is real life. When you're in the moment, it really feels that way, but it's not. And it's a good thing. Otherwise, we'd constantly be lancing each other in the streets. So, you know, I think that I find that a positive thing. So I think it's an important thing to remember anytime that, yeah, like the fact that I'm a Cardinals fan and the fact that you guys are Cubs fans does not mean that we are somehow different species or different or somehow, you know, warring factions. And I think sometimes that gets lost a little bit and therefore it can intensify the rivalry. We saw this actually, I think, happened very vividly about at the last Cardinals Cubs series in Busch Stadium, where basically what happened was there was this rumor that kind of got pushed along by Cubs Twitter that a racial slur had been used on the ESPN broadcast at Busch Stadium. Now, you guys know all how Twitter works. That plays into everyone's worst stereotype of Cardinals fans or a certain small section of Cardinals fans, which I think, you know, to be fair, I think there's been some ugliness that's gone on at Busch Stadium, particularly what you saw with the Black Lives Matter movement a couple of years ago. But certainly the idea that, like, there was not, in fact, a racial slur uttered at Jason Hayward that you could hear on the broadcast. But it got rolling, and people wanted to believe it, and Cubs fans. And you saw Cubs – you saw people in Cubs Twitter who knew it wasn't true but just couldn't resist punching the Cardinals on it, kind of like sending it along. And to me, that is – that's going the wrong direction. Demonizing someone that doesn't agree with you in a way that sports is supposed to be a refuge from. That's what politics is for. And sports is supposed to be a refuge of that. And I think sometimes social media, we tend to make bad guys and good guys out of social media because it's simpler than actually looking at each other as people.
Yeah, you know, first of all, just hearing you talk about your friend's opinion of the Cubs this year, I don't know how anybody could be confident their team's going to win the World Series when, you know, the best team in baseball maybe has a 1 in 5 chance to do that in any given year.
I tell him this.
Yeah, so you got that thing going on. Right now, I'm with you, Will. I think the Cubs are the best team in the division. I think over the regular season they probably will win the division. It wouldn't necessarily shock me if they, you know, if they finish second and got a wild card or something like that. I'm curious your thoughts on this year's Cardinals team, because in the early going, it seems like this year's Cardinals team is kind of the bizarro Cardinals from last year, where the starting pitching was so good, they had no power in the offense. Now everybody's hitting home runs, and the starting pitching's been a little shaky. What's going on?
Yeah, it's been frustrating. And it's funny, because this is actually what we thought that offense was going to be last year. I think you're seeing, you know, I Piscotty wasn't quite ready last year, but, you know, you saw... You thought you were going to get more out of Grichuk last year. You thought you remember, it's worth noting that Holiday was hurt. Matt Holiday was hurt like a third of last. He only played like 80 games last year. You know, that offense had a lot of holes in it that they weren't expecting. But we've seen a maturation of the offense this year. This is the way the Cardinals and certainly Cardinals management thought the Cardinals were going to hit last year. And now they're seeing a culmination in that. But yes, it's worth, and the thing, you know, the thing that is, I find a little encouraging about the Cardinals, even though they're, I think they're 6 games out when we talk and not currently not in a wild card spot and in third place. The thing that's encouraging is we all knew there would be a step back from the pitching. The Cardinals were a historically excellent pitching team last year. That's not, particularly on offense, not a team that had really the talent to win 100 games. So that spoke so well to the pitching. The fact that pitching has taken not just a small step back, but a big step back, to me, I think that is the aberration. I don't think the Cardinals are going to have the pitching they did last year. But if, you know, you've seen Adam Wainwright start to come back around. You've seen Carlos Martinez has taken a little bit of a step back, but there's clear talent there. The amount of talent the Cardinals have in the rotation, eventually, you know, you feel like there's nothing, you know, like with the Cubs. If the Cubs went into a hitting slump, no one's going to be like, oh, they can't hit anymore, because the Cubs have a bunch of really good hitters. The pitching is still the Cardinals' strength. What's exciting for me is to see what this offense is capable of. If you can get those two things going at the same time, which I think was the goal, one advantage for the Cardinals have as well is they have Alex Reyes, who is probably the top pitching prospect in baseball. He just came back from a 50-game suspension for using marijuana, which is in the minor leagues. Suspension once you're in the majors. Go ahead, guys. But when you're in the minors, it's a suspension. So he's just back from that. He is going to be a midseason acquisition. If there's any issues in that rotation, he is the guy that he is, the Chris Bryant in a lot of ways of starting pitchers. The Cardinals are very excited to get him in. The talent is there for the Cardinals too. Again, I think when you think of the best strengths, if you put all the, both the Cardinals and Cubs, all the strengths together, the biggest strength is the Cubs offense. I think that is the best unit of any of those units. But I think second, even with the Cardinals hitting the ball the way they have, is still the Cardinals starting pitching. And I think you'll see that come around, is that you're seeing Wainwright start to come around. They have depth there that they haven't had in the past. You know, that's what the Cardinals, that's been the great joke about these two franchises, is the Cardinals have been focusing on run prevention for the last 10 years. And the Cubs have finally, to stop them, have been focusing on offense. The irony, of course, is the reason the Cubs have taken the lead this year is because the Cardinals' defense and pitching. But I think that will come back around. Whereas I think the hitting for the Cardinals, maybe this is what they were supposed to do all along. So I mean, I'm sure this is just Cardinals colored glasses. But I think there's a lot of reason for optimism for the Cardinals heading forward.
So you think the Cardinals can overtake Pittsburgh and at least be in the wild card?
I think so. I think they're a wild card team. The problem with that this year is it's a very competitive wild card spot throughout the National League, not just Pittsburgh, but you know, Washington and the Nationals are both off to Washington and the Mets are both off to terrific starts in the NL East. The Giants are the Cubs. I talked to Cubs fans and the Giants terrified them that weekend. They look terrific against them there. And then you've got the Dodgers who have had some rotations problems, but still outside of Kershaw, but they're still talented all the way there. There are basically two teams in the East, three teams in the Central, and two teams in the West that all look to me like playoff quality teams. And if they were in the American League, I think they'd all be pretty comfortably in the playoffs. The problem is there are only five spots, only two wild card spots. So the Cardinals, I think, certainly are a wild card quality team and potentially could be an NL Central quality team, winning quality team, though I think the Cubs are a little bit above everybody else in that regard. But yeah, it's going to be tough. Even if the Cardinals are good, even if they're as good as they were last year, they played above what they should have last year. So if they play a little below what they could this year, it's going to be tough. I think they're a wild card team. Right now, I would probably pick them to get a wild card. I just think there's enough talent there to take over some of those teams. But it's going to be hard. It's a packed race in the National League, and a lot of teams are very motivated for those spots. This is not like, you know, the problem with the National League this year is there are basically six teams that are not competitive. And the Phillies have gotten off to a little better start, but they'll fall back. But otherwise, you've got five or six teams in the National League that are not actively trying to win a championship this year, which means all of the teams that are at the top are all going to be beating up on those teams all year. Winning the wild card this year could require 94 or 95 wins. It's required 97 last year. That could be the case this year, and that's going to be tough for any team to get to, not just the Cardinals.
Will Leach, U of I grad, huge Cardinals fan, writer for Sports on Earth, Bloomberg, other publications, and friend of the Bandwagon podcast. Will, thanks a lot for joining us, and great to talk Cubs cards with you.
Of course. Thanks, everyone. I apologize for the Neville Chamberlain crap. I can't resist. It inspires very negative emotions, this rivalry sometimes.
Thanks for being with us today.
Of course. My pleasure.
And Will, of course, writes for Sports on Earth, as we mentioned, and wrote an interesting article this week about the kick to the groin from Draymond Green of Golden State, who, by the way, did not get suspended for that little incident, but Will wrote a very entertaining article about that particular incident.
Can I just say the four words? Linda Holmes from NPR's Monkey See podcast called it a, quote, nut shot think piece. I had to say it.
That is such a perfect description.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you saw this, Brian, but the story, the suspension announcement, the non-announcement, was first reported by Adrian Wojnarowski.
Is that the name you're looking for?
Yes.
Wojnarowski?
I practiced this several times. I practiced it several times. Anyway, boom, it was right there. And it was, as soon as he reported it, it was considered standard. You know,
fact.
No need to follow up or anything like that. Which I think brings us into the next topic of conversation, which is not necessarily just about him, but about this giant thing that's happening in Twitter, mostly Twitter, all throughout social media, where sports organizations are using reporters are using each other and the organizations to try and break stories, try and be the first to announce a story, and also maybe trying to get, especially in the case of the agents, the players, and the sports organizations, trying to get information out there for various reasons. So I think it's very interesting, and certainly Woj has built a reputation just over the last five, 6 years of being the person to report information in the NBA first. I think he famously, you know, will announce who's being drafted right before the NBA draft, right before they actually announce it on the draft, and he's right most of the time. But a lot of people are concerned about his scruples in terms of the type of reporting he does otherwise. Is he exchanging this information for good, you know, I will give you information and then you will do a puff piece on me. So
Okay. Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, it's all part of the social media landscape that we talked about some with Will, with fan bases now going back and forth, and it goes beyond that. One interesting one where a lot of people got burned in recent months was it was widely reported that Dexter Fowler had signed a 3-year contract with the Baltimore Orioles, played with the Cubs last year, and nobody really thought he was likely to come back to the Cubs this year. They thought he would get a multi-year deal to sign elsewhere, and fairly late in spring training, it looked like he, in fact, had gotten a deal to sign with the Orioles. But that was not, in fact, the case. It sounds like that was a case where a team put out that information to reporters, basically getting other teams to back off is what it sounded like. As it ended up, though,
strategic move.
Yeah, Fowler did not get the opt-out clause that he wanted in his contract, so he ended up coming back for a 1-year deal with the Cubs.
Right. It looks like ESPN's Buster Olney, pretty well-respected reporter for baseball, did report that out in the beginning, and that looks bad for him. And then, just to follow up, Fowler's agent, this is what he had to say. In my 25 years in this business, never before have I witnessed such an irresponsible behavior on so many fronts. Both the Orioles front office and members of the media were so busy recklessly spreading rumors, they forgot or simply chose not to concern themselves with the truth.
Ouch.
Dang.
Yeah.
Ouch. Dang.
But, I think this is happening more and more, and Lisa, we were talking as our football non-Americano correspondent, you were talking about the possibility of this happening over in Europe as well.
With James Rodriguez,
right.
Who it's still not clear where he's going. And then you've got Zlatan
Ibrahimovic
or whatever, who's, you know, like he's actually perpetuating his own rumors on Instagram and Twitter. He or his representative is always talking about himself in this rather self-aggrandizing way, and now they're talking about him possibly playing a year for Manchester United, who are the Yankees of the English Premier League. Mm-hmm. Everyone hates them. They build these amazing teams, and then people leave. And incidentally, one thing that I also noticed in social media, the social media fire under the butt of Louis van Gaal, who was the coach for Manchester United, was so fierce that there is no way, in my opinion, there is no way the team could have kept him for another year. No way. The fans had just had it. The rumor mill about who was going to replace him started weeks ago. You know, like even if the front office was like, nope, we're keeping him. I mean, I think even if they had been thinking that, and I don't think they were, I think they would have had to really think twice because the social media pressure from the fans. I think the fans have a lot of power here. And the anonymity of it, we were talking, when we were planning, doing the show plan for the show, we were talking about like fake accounts and plants and people,
right.
not even real people. I mean, there's just a lot of power. A rumor can take hold and just like, you know, go viral super fast just with the fans. This isn't even like the players trash talking each other, anybody who is in a business to really know what's going on. And so I really do think like Van Gaal, they fired him because they had to. I mean, they were gonna anyway, but the social media vitriol among the fandom, and who knows who was in the fandom. It could have been players under anonymous names.
Sure.
It could have been, you know, like it was just so hateful that he had to go.
Was he the one that took over for Alex Ferguson?
Yes. And so really, you know, You're that guy who gets to do that. I mean, Sir Alex had been there for, you know, forever, beloved, whatever. Mm-hmm. And now the guy that's replacing him, you know, it's just like coach musical chairs. It's like the same eight guys coach.
Yeah, I'm hearing rumors now that Jose Mourinho may go to Man U.
I think that's happening.
And because Mourinho was just at Chelsea, and
right.
he has the reputation as a guy who comes in, has a good year or two with the team and then alienates everybody
and leaves. You know, but what's funny is social media also has a very short memory mm-hmm. when it comes to people like that. Like everybody who was just sort of like trashing him on social media, and I'm talking Twitter, Reddit, everywhere, mm-hmm. is just so excited for him. They were so tired of Van Gaal that Marino coming in, that's just great. It's like they forget what happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah, fandoms are very fickle, and Twitter does that. And, you know, it's just like Will was talking about the Cubs and Cardinals last night when I was watching the game. I immediately wanted to say horrible things on Twitter, and I consider myself somewhat reasonable.
But why do we want to do that?
I don't know.
Why do we want to do that?
And I was like, nope.
It's like an outlet, I think. It's an outlet for anyone to listen to what you're saying, rather than just being, you know, sitting with your friends. If you're watching a game like by yourself, like I was last night, Twitter is an outlet to just express what you're mm-hmm. feeling and get it out there. And you really don't all the time think about the consequences of what you might be saying in those 140 characters.
But one thing that I don't want to change the subject too much, but one thing that I did want to talk about with the reporters and I guess getting the pressure from the fans, but also is you know, the ethics of it all. Mm-hmm. This has always been going on. If you're a sports reporter, that, you know, you're always going to have sources and stuff like that. But getting information out there, it seems like there's a lot of pressure with Twitter and social media that first is the most important thing. So however you do it, it doesn't really matter. And, I mean, is that okay?
Mm. From a journalism perspective, no, it's not.
Right, but does it matter?
Yeah. Right. That's a really good question. And I think those lines have just become more and more blurred.
I think it's, yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I also think sports, like other types of entertainment, they, like, you don't have a lot of people who are following current events or the political race, although maybe this year is a little bit different with the kind of back and forth and vitriol and games won and lost and trades and this and that. And the same thing happens in the entertainment business. You were talking about how, you know, people, it's like win now, win always kind of mentality. It's the same with movies.
Right.
If a movie is like not in first place in its first week, you may as well just kiss it goodbye. I mean, the expectations are so much heavier because of social media, because, you know, if you look at like trending topics or do any kind of social listening, I mean, that is the currency now. Are people talking about you and what are they saying? And if they're not even if they're not talking, that's why I think any press is good press, right?
Right.
You know, if they're talking about you, then that means you're on the minds of people. And so sports has become much more like typical entertainment as mm-hmm. opposed to like contests and games where we're watching athletes do great things. Instead, it becomes so much more about this sort of political gamesmanship that I think is really interesting, but it also is really distracting, I think.
Lots of social media talk here on today's episode. I think we'll have to wrap it up there. And Lisa, take us out.
Here we go. So thank you, of course, from all three of us for hopping onto the bandwagon once more. There's plenty of room for everyone, including Will Leach, even if he did call me Neville Chamberlain.
There's no room for Stephen Piscotty, though.
Yeah, we don't have any room for him. So, okay, the Bandwagon Podcast is produced by us. I'm Lisa Braltz.
I'm Brian Moline.
I'm John Steinberg.
And Brian records and edits everything. John and I just hang out and talk. We don't really do anything.
That's false.
WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs is Scott Cameron. This podcast was his idea in the first place. As always, I'm kind of wondering how he feels about it now. Jim Kelly designed our logo, suggested our theme song, which just so happens to be called Bandwagon, is by the band R.E.M. Isn't that where Will Leach lives now? Does he live in Athens,
GA? He lives
GA?
In Athens, Georgia.
All right. So for now, you can find past episodes of Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu. You can find links to the articles we've discussed and some show notes and even some videos, because we love videos. I mean, don't you?
Everybody loves videos.
Sure. We are making some progress on a webpage. I promise this every time. But the big news is we have an official Twitter presence, a real handle. Follow us at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants. All the time. And from there, you are free to Twitter stalk us individually if you so desire. The next episode of The Bandwagon will come your way in a couple of weeks. We're hoping to have a webpage. I say that every time. And a podcast and iTunes. I also say that every time. But at least we've solved the Twitter issue. So please give us a follow there and tell all your friends. Until then, thanks for listening.